Matthew hangs a lot of points on mountains. It's really true. He's the one evangelist who creates, by telling the story, structures. And the structures themselves have meaning. It's not my idea. This is kind of the bailiwick of Matthew specialist. When he tells stories, he likes to have little groups of three to make a nice little triangle. And the whole book is kind of architecturally structured around five cascading discourses, with the middle one being the real point and all that kind of thing. So structure has meaning in Matthew. And it's no accident that the reading for today is an important evidence of that. Because on three occasions, Jesus takes his disciples up mountains. 1, 2, 3. And the first one you heard about, as Brian preached last week, the beginnings of the Sermon on the Mount. The second one is here. And the third one is the very last scene, which is, of course, bringing the disciples up to charge them with their mission. So the structure itself has meaning, as well as, of course, the words. And not only that, these evangelists knew their Bibles very well, and all they needed to create this wonderful story was found in the reading today, the first reading. All the words, all the images, all the grandeur, all the drama, it's all there in Exodus. And by the way, that reading itself points to something in the future as well. The other thing that's happening in this whole section, and again, only in Matthew, is that there's a studied intervention of Peter scenes in which Peter is being schooled in for his leadership. And one that takes place just before this, of course, in which he's actually described as Satan. But earlier, it's described as the rock for the church. And so we are brought together here in this place with this wonderful, wonderful inheritance. The first of these mountains is one, I have to tell you, that you're not going to find the point of sermons in many of our brothers and sisters' gatherings and churches. It just simply doesn't fit. I recently had a conversation with an old friend that left me very, very sad. And it was not meant to be sad. He was describing his conversation with someone who was seeking, and they were worried about the fact that they didn't seem to be good enough to go to heaven, and he reminded them that they didn't need to engage in good works because that was the inheritance of the old covenant, and we live in the new covenant. And of course, one simply could not read the text from last Sunday and find any sense in that at all. Do you remember what Brian preached about in that text? You must do good works. That's literally the word. Kalos erga, you must have do good works that God in heaven would be glorified. And not one letter of the law is to be diminished. Huh? And not only that, not taught to be less. The word taught to be less. And now here in this second mountain, we have exactly picking up the same personages who are quoted, the law and the prophets, Moses and Elijah, brought together in this wonderful talking together. And that's the word. It's a word that is actually used in all of the literature we can find from the ancient world, and it's a big literature, mostly in here in Mark and Matthew. It's a wonderful, wonderful word. It has what we call automatopoeia. It sounds like what it is. It's sul laluntes. Sul laluntes. Talking together. You know what, try it?
Do it with me.
Sul.
Talking together. Now, we don't know what the conversation actually concerned. If you want to know, there's any one of the TV Bible teachers who will be glad to tell you if you send them your Social Security number. But it's what we call a gap. And Matthew can tell us what Jesus said to the devil in the desert, and he can tell you what actually Jesus said to God at Gethsemane. So if Matthew wanted you to know, then it would be there. It's what we call a gap. And I want to come back to that in just a moment. But it's the third mountain that ends the book. And again, it's the gathering up of those who are to be the leaders of the mission, just as it was in 1, 2, and 3. And I remind you, in the first one, Jesus is with the crowds and takes them apart. And here he takes them apart in our reading today. And in the end of the gospel, he takes them apart. And there the instructions is plain. Now things have changed. What has changed is they are to go to all peoples. All peoples. Baptizing. And teaching them to follow all the teachings I have left you. And the word there is disciple them. Train them. Train them in the teachings. And so there you have it. 1, 2, 3. Law. Prophets, law, prophet, law, prophets. Good news. In this reading for today, Moses and Elijah come to Jesus. He's the commanding figure. I want to go back to that wonderful participle. La la luntes, talking together. Friends, I honestly believe all of you are as deeply troubled as I am right now. This is what we are not doing. This is what, as a people, we are not doing. La la luntes, talking together. And what we would bring, what would we fill that conversation with? What we would bring in talking together would be the way Jesus has made even more pointed, even more radical, even more expansive than Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets. Not just, as I'm afraid is being said by others of our brothers and sisters, all you have to do is pray this four-part Jesus prayer and you will be born again. and you will be good. You will be good. I have to tell you that back when I was a dean in a theological school, I did a lot of voluntary work in accrediting seminaries and theological schools. I got to be kind of a side gig, in fact. I went to many, many different kinds of theological schools. I don't think I ever went to a Methodist school. Yeah, I did once. But actually to Catholic schools and a lot of evangelical schools. And about the second time I was leading an examination of curriculum at an evangelical school, something dawned on me, and I said, now, wait a minute. You offer no courses in ethics, and you have no professor of ethics. Is that right? Not a single school had a professor of ethics or a required course in moral theology or, in other words, the law. Because you know why. Now, I'm pleased to say at the seminary where I was dean, we had two professors of ethics, one a classic Harvard professor and a traditional history of ethics, the other a black professor in the ethics of Martin Luther King. And many courses were required. We had not given up on the law and the prophets, but many have. One of the themes that's moving amongst us, and I want to leave you with hopefully some good news, is that we have something to carry into the conversations that need to happen across all the lines of division. And that conversation needs to be that there is a profound justice that is the heart and the soul of our grand inheritance of the law and the prophets, of Moses and Elijah. And that sound inheritance, that muscle, that core strength that we have is our devotion to the actual matters of justice. Now, it's no accident that this text is the one just before Lent. Huh? And in this incident that was read this morning, you know, Peter's not exactly wrong. He said, let's build a skene, let's build a nice tent, the three of them. And then cleverly, Matthew uses the same word in a verbal form, when the cloud tents over them, signaling we have a sanctuary, and that sanctuary is the revelation and power and majesty of Jesus. That's our tent. And it's a tent because it's not a permanent structure. It's the church becomes the tent in the valley, walking among those who live there. And as we go into our Lenten journey, we carry with us the tent of that glory that is the glory of the revelation of Moses and Elijah and Jesus. That's what we carry with us through Lent. And that's what we carry with us in our Lalaluentes. Amen.